universities is. And if you favor additional appropriations,
you want to be my guardian?
How you manage your current budget situation? In deference to our chief executive, I guess, John, we'll start with you.
Now it's working. I just needed a few extra seconds to figure out what the answer was. It was on all along. It's a big question, and it's a question that can be asked about any part of our budget. Every part, whether it's for $10 million or $1.5 billion, requires a lot of input from the chief executive as well as the legislature. But I think there's a general consensus, and the governor certainly shares it, that we're not spending enough on higher education. He had to make a very difficult decision in 2011 to cut higher ed funding by 15%, but he's been committed to getting back as quickly as possible to those 2011 levels and going past that. One of the things that we relied on heavily, both I as a legislator and now with him in the administrative office, is we took a look at the BLM report, a lot of the work that the Center for Michigan is doing, and we recognize that there's not enough money for higher education. Enrollment continues, people are still getting an education, but they're spending more to get it. It's significantly different than when I went to school, 1980 to 1984, when the state basically covered about two-thirds of the cost, and I covered a third. So we don't have a specific dollar amount. It is a priority for the governor as we move forward, but it is pitted against every other priority that we have. But $1.5 billion, we think, does need to grow over time so that we can get to a point where there is a bigger share for the state to participate in that. In terms of where would we find that money, it's all priorities. This year, a major priority for the governor and the legislature has been roads and for the citizens. It's preoccupied our conversations for months, in fact, over a number of years. And it is going to take up additional revenue. There will be other people asking for money, other constituencies that are looking for funding, K-12, you name it, community mental health, and so on and so forth. We just have to grind that through the process, and you're a major part of that, working with your legislators and working with the governor's office to talk about what those priorities are. There's no ability to easily say, well, we can cut this and increase that. Some people will suggest that we can just simply cut prison costs. Our hope is that we can reduce prison costs over time so we can dedicate more to places like higher education, but that will take time. There's no immediate fix. So what we're looking at is just setting our priorities, trying to make, through the bully pulpit, higher ed is part of our top priorities, and I'm working with our partners.
Thank you, John, very much. Representative Singh, you're front and center on this as your position as minority of vice chair of higher ed programs. What's ideal, what's realistic, and where would you get it in terms of higher ed appropriation?
Sure. I would say a few things. If you start the conversation, I think BLM has done some good analysis, fiscally in Michigan, and their report suggests we should be, at least directly to institutions, spending about $100 million more in any given year towards higher education. The second piece is we always talk about what we're directly giving to the institutions, and we rarely talk about what we're giving to the students. So we have about a little over $100 million that we give to students through a variety of scholarships and tuition programs and incentives. But if you look at that, we're one of the last states for investment. We're either 47, 48, 49, or 50, depending on the year. So if you want to be in that top 10, as we often talk about the top 10 states, you need to probably be doing at least $200 million more. And if you want to be the best state, you've got to be doing $300 million more towards those types of programs. So we're talking about it. We're underinvesting right now in higher education about $400 million on any given year. So that's the ideal, right? If you want to be the best, the top in investment, you should be at that level. So what is the reality? Obviously we have, as John mentioned, we're talking about roads. This week we can actually seriously hamper and hinder the growth long-term for higher education in a variety of other areas. if we pass a plan that my colleague in the House puts down. Because when you look at some of the assumptions long term for that, we're not growing higher education or K through 12 above inflation. So, and at no point will we see an increase in any of those types of areas over inflation. In most instances, we'll probably see under inflation growth in those areas of a 1% or 1.5%, maybe 2% on a given year. And that's assuming and hoping that we don't have a recession at some point in time where those numbers would go down. Because again, the Rhodes Plan is very optimistic. It suggests that we'll have 15 years of growth the last 6 or so years, and then we'll continue for the next 7. And so I'm really concerned about that long term. I do hope that I thought we should have been able to get back to the 15% cut this year. I thought that was a reasonable piece. Unfortunately, that's not the case. You know, I'm at least hopeful that we'll get to the 15% cut in every institution at that 15%, not just an overall 15% by the end of the governor's term. I don't see it moving any other direction. But I do think, how do you fund it? You're going to have to really find a dedicated source of revenue for higher education. We cannot keep relying on the school aid fund to fund higher education. We need to have a conversation specifically with the business community and with other partners. If we really want this workforce and talent that is coming out of these institutions, we have to invest in it appropriately. And so I do think as part of a long-term conversation, we have to have a dedicated source of revenue. And that should be part of any kind of conversation over the next 3 years. That we find that, and so we can actually put the resources towards higher education.
Sam, by dedicated source of revenue, do you mean a portion of a certain kind of tax or a special tax for higher ed?
Well, I think we have to find new revenue, unfortunately. It would be ideal if you could just take a portion of the income tax and say, hey, we're going to dedicate it towards that, but that's perhaps how we're going to fix the Rhodes crisis. And so if the reality is if we're not willing to raise the right appropriate revenue for Rhodes, maybe people will be more willing and able to raise the revenue necessary for the next generation of workers of the state. And that's, to me, where you have to do it. So whether it's a brand new fee or tax, or you have to then find a dedicated form in there, I think that's where you have to go. If you really want to solve this problem, if you want to just increase higher ed by 2%, 10%, then you should do what we're doing right now. But I don't think you solve the long-term problem.
John Austin, what's your sense? Ideal, realistic, and how to pay for it?
So I want to come back to your economic impact and power of investing in higher education. It's probably the most impactful investment to make when you're about jobs or economy. But there has been a group present time referred to a Cherry Commission 11 years ago. I thought she was talking about the Cherry Commission. She was talking about another commission that took a hard look at how we do post-secondary training in Michigan. And many of the stakeholders in this room, including on stage, have been meeting and working together over the last year to take another look at that same topic. What are the big moves? And we're going to share our recommendations soon. And we'll review by the governor. Maybe let's get the Detroit important to deal with that. But we're coming out with some of the ideas that are really tended to the conversation. In those discussions, we've heard we don't need some of the levels of the strategy for how our investments produce people with degrees and credentials. And this group is saying there's three parts of that strategy. One is let's get back into the top 10 in need-based financial aid. It is an enabler. If it's not, there's a blocker if people aren't pursuing post-secondary. So we've got to make those moves the government talked about to increase our investment. The other is let's continue the progress for BLM's encouragement and what's been happening in recent years to invest in universities, our new college institutions so they can be competitive and do their jobs, which has to do with building that pathway of opportunity and creating new jobs and innovation. And finally, let's make strategic investments in things we know move the needle on post-secondary attainment. Things like investing in expanding early, middle, college, or technical that delivers post-secondary credentials while you're in high school. Tremendous power to triple those numbers. Let's invest in enhancing the guidance and counselors' capacity and numbers. Small amount of money can go a long way to reduce that 700-to-1 ratio and to support counselors to guide the college career readiness. Let's support our institutions to the kind of complete
completion and success strategy to organize around how to complete the dream not to show up. So instead of initiative that costs a little bit of money, and extending the safety guard to consistent with that last discussion, so we know where people end up when they graduate, whether they're working or what. There are small investments that can help us produce a bigger result.
Jen, where would you get the money from?
Well, I'm for one who says we need to, at some point, reform our tax system so that we are putting more investment in higher education and education resources. I think that's a big project, but at some point we need to step up and do it. So you could raise more revenue. But the share of our income that we save, which your efforts this morning that we put into education and education at large, is down from 10, 15 years ago. Just where the money we have. 4.1% of our income went to education. Now it's 3.4%. Whatever money we have. What's the money to up that investment to take the path to a brighter future?
John Walsh. What's your general sense, well, specifically in your office, but you've also served in the legislature, so you have a great sense of that over there, too. Where does college affordability rank in the constant churn of issues that policymakers are dealing with? You've got Detroit schools, the road funding, and then there are surprises and traumas like the Flint water situation right now. Where does the focus of this conference fit in that refrigerator list down the road?
It's a good question, and the legislators, I think part of it, there's a lot of churn in the legislature because of term limits. And the unfortunate part is just as you find the individuals that you, as a conference, as good members, reach out, start to work with somebody, they get educated, they learn what the issues are, they get ready to advocate for that, and then they're on their way out, particularly in the House. You get 6 years on the way out. Then maybe you get 8 years, you might continue on, but it's a pretty quick churn. And so you're in a reactive mode in the legislature trying to learn where the priorities are. And while there is some tremor that comes from students and parents that talk about the cost of university educations for higher education, including community colleges, the fact of the matter is we have record-breaking enrollment. So there isn't an apparent crisis. I think amongst ourselves we would agree that there is because we're not able to afford the access we might want to. But in the economic reality of our citizenry, they may complain about the cost, but they're still enrolling at record numbers. They're still applying at record numbers. So it's very hard for a legislator or a governor to look and say, we need to move resources out of this budget where we might have a crisis to another budget where, yes, it's expensive to the citizens. But it hasn't reached the crisis yet. Now, the sadness in that statement is we shouldn't be legislating or administering based on the amount of a crisis. But that's where term limits hurts us, is the ability to see issues over the long haul or react to things as they come along. So the churn, unfortunately, is going to continue. It's just inherent in the way that we've set up our government. You know, democracy is already difficult to get anything passed. It's almost inherent by design to get things passed out of two chambers and get a governor to agree to it. But when you have people that have less background than they should have making the decisions because of lack of experience, not intelligence or commitment, the lack of experience is very difficult to get that moving forward.
The governor is famous for being a nerd and looking at accounting. You put a number on the board earlier today, student debt. It's $2 billion this year at the 15 publics. It's more than doubled in the past 20 years. Debt per student, now about 6,600. It's more than doubled. But enrollments are not dropping. So that's part of the picture that legislators have to keep in mind, Sam.
Yeah, absolutely. I think John's right. This is not a top priority for the legislature. I think on any given year, when I go through the appropriations process, now I've gone through my third budget, maybe the people around appropriations really are talking about it, but we're not hearing from our colleagues outside of that process, hey, we need to put more money here. We'll hear about other issues, but I don't hear people talking more specifically about higher education. We'll talk about K-12 education. I'm not hearing that from my colleagues, so I don't think it's at the top 6-7 issue area. You know, I think there is a crisis, and I think you mentioned it, on the student side. It's not on what we normally legislate as legislators and hear from our institutions. You know, people view the individual debt of an individual as their issue, not necessarily the state's issue. And and I would say that to some degree we have helped facilitate this debt crisis amongst these students. So for us to be able to solve that long term, especially since you can't, you know, remove that student debt the way you could remove other debt, I do think that there is a crisis point out there that we should be taking a look at. Maybe my colleagues don't understand it. I definitely know the governor and the governor's team understands that. And so for us, I think we have to figure out that system that lessens that. And then also the federal conversation as well, because I do think we have to readjust debt long-term and so forth. That has to happen on the federal level. But there are definitely things that we should be doing on the state level to be able to mediate that.
I think there are some student leaders, campus leaders in the room. If there are, would you raise your hands? Okay. Question and answer. First question goes to, first two questions go to students. We want to hear from you on this panel, okay? So think of something good.
No pressure.
We'll come back in just a minute. Dan Austin, you recently described college costs as an economic crisis. I think the word you used is crushing debt loads on students, and it's a hindrance to college completion as well. The public also views college costs and debt loads as the main burden of college completion. We just talked about the loan numbers that may not be reaching the legislators' phone lines yet, but they're certainly reaching the checkbooks around kitchen tables. Other than appropriations, that argument's been made very clear today. Other than that, what are some other ways we, as policymakers, should be addressing student debt?
There are some things, and we're going to encourage them that can reduce the time and the cost of both personal expenditure and our tax dollars by how do we help and institutions help not let people wander around and pile up excess credits that don't transfer, don't turn into a credential degree, and they end up wasting money in ours. How do we provide guided pathways? How do we structure and support decision making and guidance and counseling? So, and how do we better articulate the been talked about today, the recommendations we need to execute to extend the acceptance of a variety of degrees and credits between institutions and those kinds of packages and streamline the clock and make it much more efficient and help more people ultimately complete degrees. And there are also things about let's pay or we do more financial aid, let's link it to earning credits or earning credentials. So that we're paying for results, not just paying for, you know, showing up and seeing time. And those are definitely changes we need to make. But I think I would come back to, you have to remake this basic market. It used to be all of us paid for all of our young people and some older people to get a great education, one of our great institutions of learning. And now we're asking individuals, and many of them can't afford it. As I said, the folks who don't ever drop out and don't really get a credential that are the most at risk, and they don't owe a lot of money, but they're at sea in our economy, and we can't afford to lose them. And that's part of why we have to remake the basic part, and that we collectively need to support more of our people getting degrees and credentials that matter for them to navigate and create new jobs and being entrepreneurs here in Michigan.
John Walsh, the governor this morning, he clearly anticipated the money fight question that has evolved throughout this morning. And just my perception, he was tired of it before it even began today. Beyond appropriations, beyond money, how else can policymakers address college affordability, student loan debt?
I think just on that comment, John, first, I remember the governor early on when he took office. He just could not believe that every conversation that he had in the governor's office began with money on every single subject. And he tries to turn the dialogue a little bit and talk about what are the alternatives. Money is a big part. And it's taxpayer dollars through the state and rededicated to positions that we think that are important. But there are things that he celebrates and I think really have been a great idea. The universities and community colleges worked hard, and they still are working on it, but there's a transfer program of 35 credits from community colleges to higher ed to make it easy for the student. It's that intersection that we focus on, and we'll provide whatever support we can as an administration working with our legislative partners, is how do we make it easier for the student to get credit in high school and move on to community college or university? How can we remove barriers? How do we ease that process towards an education? And then make sure that by focusing on things like counseling, Have any of you been at meetings where the governor will ask rhetorically, or not rhetorically, he wants to know, how many of you had a good experience with your counselor? And I said, and people really struggle with that. Sometimes people have great counselors, and others not so much. But we know today that the burden on a counselor is dramatically different than it was 10 and 15 years ago. There are less counselors for students. If we had more, introspection on the part of the student, more guidance from a counselor to help them get to the degree that makes sense for their interests and that leads to a job in the future, that might be part of it as well.
Thank you. I certainly have more questions I could ask, but I would truly like to give our student leaders an opportunity to have a voice today. And I'm sorry to put you on the spot, but this is your turn. Please, any student leaders in the room today, if you'd like to offer a question or an observation, please do so. Don't be shy. Here we go. Tell us where you're from. And you don't have to sing the alma mater, but tell us where you're from.
Grant Strobel, University of Michigan. My question is just kind of thinking through the entire conference today. As a university, if I was an institution and I have such a high demand of students willing to pay the high price from out of state to come here, and then on the other hand, if they can't afford to pay it, then there's federally backed loans, there's subsidy financial aid. So what incentive as a university do I have to increase costs when I can get all this money from students paying $50,000 a year? And use that to pay for all the different programs that I want to invest in, and then pay for a huge amount of administrative staff that's almost the same amount as undergraduate students. So to me, like, going through this is, as an institution, what incentive do I have to control costs?
John Walsh, the governor touched on that a little bit this morning, where he was pushing back and saying efficiencies. We've heard the public say similarly. How often does that come up in the budget negotiations, the budget talks, the pushback on universities to do more to control costs?
Well, it comes up plenty in terms of controlling costs, and it's interesting because you'll see some aha moments, but to Sam's point, the Appropriations Committee hears them, but perhaps not others. When presidents come up and they'll talk about cutting their healthcare costs, 10-15%, when they reduce their administrative burden, they'll report that to the Appropriations Committee. This is very carefully, it goes into the comment, but it doesn't always get out to the full membership, even though the Appropriations Committee members do try to educate folks. But again, it goes back to a lack of a relationship with our universities. There isn't a deep understanding in the legislature as to what is going on there. So you're left with impressions, your own personal impressions or the impressions of students or parents that come forward and talk about it. But a well-placed package is a request that says, this is how much it costs me to educate a student. These are the expenses that are involved. These are where I'm making my cuts. Why we think they're efficient and effective. And then measuring things. And thanks to a lot of work by BLM, we now have been working with national measurements, not just the state or institutional measurements. But that's been a big improvement in taking a look at efficiency.
Sam, what's your perspective on the student's question about efficiency, and where's the incentive for universities to control costs?
Sure, I think it's in two ways. I think there's a implicit in the question. There is a constant struggle that some institutions have, whether or not you take out-of-state students, whether you take international students, and what's the right balance there. So I think that's something that those types of institutions that have that type of makeup have to grapple with. And you would hope that the boards that were either appointed by the governor or voted by the people are taking a look at that, because obviously we're investing taxpayer dollars into these institutions. You know, I think to some degree, over the last 3 years, I've seen a lot of reports coming in from at least 15 public institutions, not out of the community college portion of the Appropriations Committee, but I've seen cuts that have been made, the efficiencies that have been made. Now, sure, there's probably significant more that can be done, but I've seen a lot that has been done. I think that's because of
the focus that the legislature has had on making efficiencies. Now, at the same time we've done that, we've created a salary, not a salary cap, I'm thinking about football at this moment, but we've created a tuition cap for institutions. And, you know, that to some degree does create some of that efficiency, enforces that conversation, but at the same point in time, if the legislature doesn't invest appropriately long-term in that, it makes no sense to have a tuition cap, because it might make sense institutionally by their leadership has to go above that tuition cap. And we saw that happen 2 years ago by one institution, and this year by two institutions. And I've said to people, why are you surprised by that? Because you give them such a little amount every year. At some point, the CEOs of these organizations and the board of directors of these organizations, if they were in the private sector, would be doing this. And so we should expect the same thing to be happening by these institutions. And so I think there's a combination of the boards have the incentive. I think there is, because of our tuition cap, there's another incentive there. And then the reporting mechanisms that come back to us have some of that. But there's obviously more efficiency that can be done.
And do we have any other about the efficiencies and the importance of finding more reallocated resources, not giving new money. But we've got to appreciate these institutions of higher education and research are economic engines. You're at a world-class institution. University of Michigan and our great universities, they create more wealth, they create new knowledge, they create new businesses that spill over them. They make communities that are so attractive to talent and people that have nothing to do with the university but who choose to live, work, and run their business in those communities. Look at Ann Arbor. So these are economic engines, and trust me, we're competing. University of Texas, University of Virginia, they're trying to take and steal our best people who attract masses of research dollars, who create new economic activity here. And it's competitive, and we need to fund them because these are engines. They're probably the most powerful economic engines we have. Who would trade our set of learning institutions, research institutions, and other states would kill to have what we got. And we need to rebuild it, not eviscerate.
If you're a student, please tell us what university you're from and your question.
Yeah, my name is Anthony Wagner. I'm actually a recent alum from the University of Michigan, Dearborn. I graduated in 2014, and I graduated with $60,000 in debt. So, you know, I think I fall on the high end of the spectrum for a bachelor's degree. But I wanted to kind of direct the conversation and say that I don't think enough of it is being had around all of the extra fees beyond tuition that we haven't really addressed. Is we're looking at huge costs, other fees, especially associated with labs. And I think that, you know, I would be curious to look back at my $60,000 and see what percentage of that is actually fees beyond tuition, seeing if there are some reductions that can be made there, and looking especially at textbooks, labs, et cetera.
Looking at those costs, have those been part of the performance funding mechanism? Is there scrutiny of things like the textbook cartel, if it exists?
There's definitely, when you take a look at institutionally charged fees, they're part of that. So we do get a report about what all the different types of fees that the university is charged. It doesn't answer the question per se, like how do you manage that, right? So that's another, I think, separate conversation. What do you do about academic labs? How do you deal with textbooks and so forth? I think that's a separate conversation. But part of the examination the legislature is doing does include those seats.
Just as our universities have collectively have expanded out of state in order to subsidize operations and serve in-state students, which I think they'd rather do. Phil Power mentioned this morning, without that basic model of broadly contributed state support, they become, you know, a paid-for-service enterprise for the individual, and a lot of hidden fees are a way that they make up the resources that have been, over the years, taken away from the generalized state support that we used to provide. And I said, we got to walk back up that state support while helping them execute programs that do ensure they complete people, that do make sure they squeeze their dollars for maximum impact. We got to work smarter, and we have to reinvest in these institutions.
But, sir, to your question, I hope my colleagues at Bridge Magazine are listening to your story and can review things like textbooks and other student fees in more detail. I think it's worthy of more. more scrutiny. To close this panel out, do we have one more student question? We'd like to give you the last word here with our policymakers. Thank you. Tell us where you're from.
I'm from the University of Michigan, and I have two comments. The first one is an agreement with the fact that credits and ongoing credits into college are a major issue. In high school, I took International Baccalaureate, and at the University of Michigan, that counts as core credits. So I went in, I only had to take one science class, done with my science credits. I could probably graduate early with the amount of International Baccalaureate credits that I went into. Saves a lot of money. I know tons of my friends took AP credits, and they do not count as core for Michigan. They count as electives, almost as nothing. So they have to, even though they took the same thing as me, and mine's named differently, they still have to take all the required classes without any credit subsidy and go through 4 years. The second comment is on regards to the graduation rate with college. And I agree that's an issue with college, but I believe also you have to look at it from bottom downward. I believe that it also you have to put blame on a broken education system, K through 12, where the United States ranks below the median of OECD countries when it comes to test scores, and kids are coming into college unprepared because the schools are underachieving in our country. So
I'll turn to John and John to close us out with responses to both of those issues, because I know you're working on credit transfer issues, and I know you're both up to your ears in K-12 matters. So, John?
And as President of the Board of Education, I'll take responsibility for our broken K-12 system. Clearly, we have to do a heck of a lot better. We have to lay the foundation of the job, but we know how powerful it is. We're making the steps. We have to form and reimagine how we can take K-12 for success. Let's start with the place right now, and let's go on. But we really can't lose sight of the fact that these higher education opportunity building for people and greasing this system so it works smarter, so that we are having a system that allows you to move seamlessly. Stay tuned. There'll be a lot of good recommendations coming out soon about improvements we can make to streamline the system so that people can move through more successfully, less time, less money, and complete any of valuable form of post-secondary education credentials. We also want to unify that to make sometimes it's all valuable, whether it's a career technical degree or a master's degree or an anthropology degree. It helps you play in the labor market. It helps you get a job, keep a job, make more money. The more post-secondary education or credential you earn, the better off you are, the better off we the state are, we're richer. If other people without degrees make more, there's lots of good evidence. This is one of the most important priorities we can make for our state. To grow our economy in the future.
I would add to that, just don't forget the power that the students you have and that your parents have. If you're a parent of a college-age student, I get an email. I'll see, this really goes more to your key question, I'll bring it back to yours on the transfer. I'll see a email and be like, what the hell? I might go upstairs and say that to my wife and, you know, be a grouch for a while, but I haven't called Dr. Simon yet about it. And I should. Just tell me what it's going to cost. And I'll write you a check. But make it easy. Now, the transfer credits, as you're shopping schools, it's really important for students, whether you're coming from high school or community colleges, to look at the partners that say, we're going to take these credits. And make a very market-based decision between that. From a legislative standpoint, you know, I'd be loath to suggest that the legislature should dictate whether the governor should try to instruct how he might accept credits. But we're certainly ready to work with anybody that is ready to work with us to put whatever we can effort-wise to make it easier for the students so that the credits do transfer, so that we can make it a little easier of a system. The governor talked about this at the president's probably in March time period, roughly, and one of the presidents said, but governor, if I don't have X percentage of freshmen and sophomore, I take too many transfer students, I can't do the full things I want to do in my junior and senior year on my master's program at the cost that I'm doing it. And his comment was, that's a man problem. That's a man problem. So if it hurts you to encourage transfer students, more high school credit,
transfer from community colleges that help describe that problem to us, and we can work with our legislative partners and try and find a way so that no institution is harmed because we made it easier for the student to progress through the system.
And John, if I could just add one thing, I think we have to look at remediation differently as a system. I think we're spending too much time at community college level, and even at the 15 universities doing remediation. Is there a way to do it cheaper outside of those systems? That is kind of a different concept where we're not getting all this debt also accumulated. But I think it's a very significant conversation that, you know, unfortunately, because we're just going year to year, on budget types of things, we don't really have that type of conversation. But to me, I think it makes sense to have the conversation about remediation outside of these institutions, back in the community setting, and then those students be prepared and ready to move forward. So I think that type of conversation needs to happen as well.
Two thank yous here. First of all, to our students, college students who managed to take the time out of your schedules to be here today and add your voices to the conversation. It's very important. Thank you for doing so. And also thank you to our policymakers, John and Sam, for taking the time to be here and for a professional perspective that we all might get from these people down the street. Thank you very much, and if you all give a round of applause.